guys. I'm K2, Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the technical met, which exists most Sunday evenings for the last 32 and a fraction years, on Sunday nights to gather curious radio amateurs, electronic enthusiasts in general, who want to know more about the wireless process. How does radio work? How do antennas work? Transmission lines and antenna analyzers and matching networks and so on. Propagation, and there's 26 different kinds of ham radio. So if the particular kind of ham radio you're using is not completely pleasing you, before you give up this extremely educational hobby, I recommend you try one of the other 25. We follow a kind of a loose schedule, which gets changed from time to time. At people's suggestion, we've developed it over the last 30-some-odd years, where for the first hour or so, we take general questions for people who want to know something more about how their equipment is working, how to make it work better, the so-called question and answer period, approximately an hour. That's followed by John, KC2WGB, who maintains the mailbag. For those who don't have an amateur radio license or the right equipment to talk to us yet, they send their questions to John, and he selects the ones that are of most general interest. We go through a few of those. After John's mailbag, and he monitors the echo link. So for people who have trouble getting through by way of echo link, John knows about it and brings it to our attention, because sometimes we don't wait long enough for all four beeps in between each transmission. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, who tonight most likely will be giving us a space report number 162 of this. And so, Paul really keeps track of what NASA and other agencies putting up space hardware have been doing. So, a person signs into the technical net because they do have a question or a comment, and they are going to give us their call letter, their name, and the word yes. And along the way, we also, from time to time, hear from our celebrity Hal, K6DPZ, who has a lot of experience with a lot of radio equipment. He also is that famous person who has that airplane, which is now being called the Spirit of Oceanside. It's a Cessna 152 airplane mounted in his front yard. Okay, give me your questions, your call letters and name right now if you do have a question or a comment for the net. K2RIW listening.
N2EO Dick with a question.
Okay, I heard Rich, and there was another one in there who was doubling with Rich. I did hear another person besides Rich trying to sign in. Can that person give me their call letters and name right now?
Enter Exian. Do you have a chat?
Yes, I did. Okay, I did, Wes, see your latest submittal. Okay, let's start off with Rich. N2EO, what would you like to talk about tonight, Rich? K2RIW.
So, space reporting is going to preserve the time for me. But it's an answer from Roy as well. That is, he could participate in the discussion. Enjoy it.
Should I pick it up?
You got it, Rich.
Recommended we have a chip put into marriage.
a veterinarian can read the tag and it has the information as to the animal's owner, animal's address, what kind of an animal, and so on. What you're also sounding like you're looking for is the so-called RFID chip. In other words, you can put a kind of a radio tag, a passive radio tag, on pieces of material that you want to keep track of, like, for instance, boxes that you've got in the warehouse, or individual shipping containers that come into your place of business. And those RFID tags, the good news is they've got 96 bits of possible information, and on a good day they can be read at something like 15 or 20 feet. That's the good news. There's a catch, and that is the way the RFID tag works, and the most the long-range ones, let me drop. The ones with the greatest range work on the frequency region of 902 to 928 megs. Happens to be the exact same frequency range as the ham radio 900 meg band. Center frequency is 915. You get the greatest amount of range out of 915 megahertz tags. That's the good news. The bad news is if you put them up against a bottle of soda, which contains a lot of water, or you put them against the skin of a human being or the skin of an animal, the range starts falling off real fast, because at 915 megacycles, water is an extremely good dummy load material. In fact, the very first person who ever built waveguides, Mr. Southworth, way back in the late 30s, literally built waveguide. His first piece of waveguide was a piece of downspout tubing, the kind you use on your house. That was a piece of S-band waveguide, and he tilted it at a very shallow angle into a trough of water. So if there was a wedge of water inside the waveguide, that presented a perfect dummy load. The signal got down there slowly, got introduced to the water, the wedge shape of the water, and all of it got absorbed, and essentially nothing got reflected back, and it's a very high power load. My bottom line of this is, let me drop. Anything containing a lot of water is very lossy to an RFID tag. So an RFID tag that's against the skin of an animal or against your skin is going to have drastically decreased range. They do put RFID tags on the identification badges that people appear at a conference. And because each doorway you go through has antennas that are reading that tag, and because those antennas are only a couple of feet from you, they can live with the disadvantage of the high dissipation of the human being that they're up against. As I said, on a good day, you can read one of those tags at roughly 20 feet. If it's on a cardboard box and it's 20 feet away from you in a warehouse, as long as the cardboard box doesn't have water in it, you're probably going to be able to read that tag. To track your animal at a 20-foot range, if you were getting the 20-foot range, would not be as long as you'd like it to be. Let me drop. You'd like to be able to track your pet at a much greater distance than 20 feet, but you wouldn't even get 20 feet. You would only get a few feet of range. So the RFID tags and tracking an animal that might wander off your property and you want to find the animal, not so good. To put the tag on the animal, no matter which kind of a tag, where it's going to be read by a veterinarian to make sure that they know who that animal belongs to and what kind of an animal it is, that can be done. So maybe that's part of what you were asking, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Stake N2EO. I'd also like to know how much data can they get in there? Can they get the medical history of the dog? Like how many shots, when were the shots given, that sort of thing. Over.
When it comes to the non-RFID tag, that animal that the veterinarians have been using for some time, how many bits of information, I don't know. When it comes to the RFID tag at 915 megacycles that I'm talking about, the ordinary run-of-the-mill tag has 96 bits of information, and there are specially made tags that have multiples of 96 bits. In the case of a 96-bit tag, and one of the versions of the tag is rewritable. You can literally put that tag on a box that's being shipped from Shenzhen, China, and maybe it's going to go to two separate ports before it gets to New York or California. And as it goes to each one of those reports, each one of those ports, you can write into the tag what hour it arrived, what hour it left, whether or not the shipping container was opened, what was the weather like. All kinds of information can be put in there. The whole great big story can be written in that tag, because 96 bits of information, 2 to the 96th power, tells you how many bits of information, if you know what I mean. It's a lot. How many different states. So the RFID tag, lots of information can be put in there. I don't know about the other kind of tag. Let's see if anyone else knows about the kind of tags they put on animals to keep track of them, how much information they can contain. I'm going to pass it over to Rich N2EO with a delay. If anyone else has knowledge on the other kind of tags, please give us your call at us at this time. N2EO with a delay, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comical, but the guy recognized her and brought her back. does have a animal tag collar.
Thank you, John. Let's see what Eric's got to say on the subject. KE2EJ, K2LIW, how would you measure power beyond 50 watts without spending a whole pile of money? You got it, Eric.
I always use a kind of slug. But anyway, I'm turning the repeater off for about 3 or 4 minutes, so stand by.
Roger, Roger. We'll stand by for 3 or 4 minutes while you turn the repeater off.
And a lot of us didn't hear John's answer.
Sounds like I always think they do make a kilowatt version. Over to you for that one, John.
Maybe, Dick, I'm not sure. When I get up in that tower, I go to the bird units. You know, I have the through lines and the terminated ones. That's when I get up in that tower, I like to use the bird stuff. But let's hear from Eric and see what they make that I've never heard of.
I want you to start up your ICQ so I can send you a message. Or I'll send it to you via email, whatever your choice is.
Email is the best way to send me a message right now, Eric. But you're saying that MFJ does make one beyond 200 watts, or 400 watts. Yeah, I think it's at 200 watts. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Are we talking about tuners or power meters?
Power meters. What Ray was asking us is he can't find any power meters above plus 47 dBm. And I think the MFJ goes above that. Over to you, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Well, they make kilowatt antenna tuners. You know darn well that they make meters. Although I wouldn't buy an MFJ power meter. I'd buy a bird, but since I have a couple, I don't have to buy one.
In the case of being brand new or on the used market, what is a bird model 43, the through-line watt meter going for these days? Roughly how many bucks, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
To be quite honest, I really don't know what they're going for. I suspect they're in the $300 to $400 range just for the meter. Thinking about the slugs.
Now the good news about the bird model 43A through-line watt meter is it is considered an industry standard. Just about every person doing service, radio service, uses one of those to measure forward and reverse power, and then look it up or calculate the standing wave ratio from that. So they're traceable to the Bureau. Everybody uses them. It's been around for a zillion years, and so nobody questions the use of a bird watt meter. From time to time, you'll hear people with crazy theories saying that the bird watt meter will only read accurately if there's a certain number of wavelengths of cable between the bird watt meter and the antenna. Absolutely not true. If you read the manual, it doesn't give you any such information, the owner's manual. But there are lots of hams out there saying that. And there are even significant people at League headquarters, until I wrote them some letters, used to say that. They've even said that in the last year or so in some of their articles, that the bird watt meter will not read accurately if there isn't a fixed number of wavelengths of cable. So it looks like MFJ has a less expensive version. And if you're willing to go to the right surplus market, John did recently. He found a very good deal on a bird watt meter recently. So occasionally they show up used. And in the case of a bird model 43, even if it's got a dented case and it's been thrown down a flight of stairs, let me drop. The actual electronics inside, so simple that I would still buy it. I wouldn't worry about whether or not it can fix it. Guarantee you can fix it. About the worst thing I can think of that can happen to a bird is heavy damage to the Dawson's valve movement, the actual meter on it. But that element could be a little bit difficult to repair. But as long as it's got a working meter, I wouldn't care how bad the rest of it is. It's all fixable, if you know what I mean. AC2, MMY, K2LIW, over to you, Ray.
ZDX for the comment.
Yeah, stand by a minute, Ray. Go ahead, Mr. ZDX.
So the price of about every single MFS, there are people selling bird watt meters anywhere between $125 and $200. That's usually with no slug or maybe with one slug. Go ahead, Eric. Go ahead, Dick.
Dick?
Hi, thank you, Jerry. Good information. Go ahead, Eric.
Hi, do you remember your favorite frequency and a favorite PL tone? Okay. Instead of it being a 1, make it 1125 and go there.
Roger, Dodger. I'll give that a try. And I think you're saying it's now operational.
This should be.
Why?
Okay, I'm hearing you very well, Ray, so go right ahead. KC2MMY, K2LAW. Looks like Jerry thinks that you will be able to find a bird because they're sold in almost every flea market. The world's filled up with them, so to speak. You've got it, Ray.
Yeah, I guess that would be more clear. I guess what I was trying to ask is I'm looking at a Hewlett Packard digital power meter. It's not handheld. It's one of the box. You know, I guess it's 8x8. John's probably familiar with it. I don't remember the model. What, 30-something? 630-something? And it's a 25-watt input, I guess direct RF input. I don't know how many dBm's that is. Maybe it's only 4 dBm's or something like that. And so I guess what I'm asking is, what's the typical application for that? How can I relate it, or how can I use it for ham radio? Do I start to need attenuators and things to use it? What's the typical application? Because it only goes, they only go to like 25 watts. So I'm looking at buying one of these things on eBay because, you know, it looks cool. Back to you, Dick.
If I had a meter that only went to 25 watts, and I trusted it and loved it and wanted to be able to measure power output for my transmitter, the easiest way to use that would be to put a fixed attenuator in front of it. If the attenuator I put in front of it was 10 decibels, a 10 decibel RF attenuator will convert to 400 watts to 40 watts, if you know what I mean, or 250 watts to 25 watts. There's a 10 to 1 ratio in power when you're using a 10 decibel attenuator. Now, the problem though is that a 10 decibel attenuator that can tolerate 250 watts of input is going to be something with great big heat fins on it, unless you're only using it for 1 second at a time, if you know what I mean. So, no matter how you absorb 250 watts in my example, a 250 watts input to a 10 dB attenuator. On the back end of that attenuator, you would get 25 watts, and you can put that into your watt meter. And so everything you read off that watt meter, you just simply multiply it by 10. But a 10 dB attenuator with 250 watts, it's dissipating that amount of power, 90% of it. You can make up a 10 dB attenuator by using the right length of the right kinds of coaxial cable. That would be a distributed attenuator, and it would easily dissipate the power because it's got all of that length and all of that air circulating around it. Let me drop. But calibrating it would be a bit of a problem. You may read up in the manual of your particular favorite kind of cable, and maybe it's got at 2 meters, maybe it's got 5 dB of loss per 100 feet, and you're looking for 10 dB of loss. And so you use a 200-foot length of it. That's one approach. And even though it's rated for 5 dB per 100 feet, that manufacturer, if he's a real good commercial-slash-military guy, he's conservative. He's rating it at 5 dB per 100 feet at 2 meters, but maybe it's really 4.8, and he's got a little bit of leeway in there to make sure that he doesn't get a rejection of that particular production run. So therefore, you might have to calibrate it. One other thing wrong with using a coaxial cable as an attenuator is that as it heats up, the attenuation will shift a little bit. So you'll think that your transmitter is slightly fading in power as you press the key down and wait for 3 minutes, and you see the power decrease a little bit. Well, the heating of the cable could be doing that. Lots of guys have used cable as an attenuator. Not a bad way to go, but it's got a couple of disadvantages. You'd have to calibrate it, and you'd have to worry about it slightly changing as a function of heating. Now, the good news about an attenuator, if you're trying to find out will your particular length of cable act like a 10 decibel attenuator, in my example, you don't have to test it at the 250-watt level. You can test it at the 25-watt level, or the 2.5-watt level, or even the 50-milliwatt level. As long as the meter you've got on the far end of your cable is sensitive enough, 10 dB of attenuation is not power sensitive per se. So it'll give you 10 dB of attenuation whether you're running a milliwatt or a kilowatt. So that's the good news about attenuators. So maybe that'll give you some hints. There also are ways that you could build a directional coupler. Let me drop quick. You could put on the inside of your transmitter a little bit of piece of wire that is placed somewhat close to the center conductor of the coax cable that goes from the real electronics base of your transmitter, and it goes out the output connector at the back panel. And you could sneak a piece of enameled wire under that braid of that coax cable, and that could be made into a power sensing device. That piece of wire, one end grounded, the other end going to an attenuator, going to a resistor, and a diode rectifier into a meter. That would be a poor man's power meter that you could put right inside your transmitter itself. It's not a very difficult thing. It's not a very difficult, not a very complicated circuit. To properly get it calibrated, I'll admit, represents a little bit of a problem. You could find out how sensitive it is, and then bring your transmitter over to somebody's house that's got a bird one meter to compare the results. KC2MMY, K2.
Comment, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
One way to very simplify it is, at a ham fest, he could pick up a directional coupler, whatever frequency, and he can use a detector and a cheap little DC meter, and he can calibrate the whole setup with a bird or whatever he wants to use at low power, and it should extrapolate out in a linear fashion. I think that would work. It would be very inexpensive and fairly accurate.
Yeah, that's a nice, that's quite a bit more sophisticated and a nice approach. Directional couplers, quite often a flea market, sell for numbers like $5 and $10, even though brand new they were $1,500, because most people don't understand them. On top of that, you would think you want a directional coupler for the 144 meg cycle region, for instance. Absolutely not. Not required. As long as the directional coupler is made for a frequency that you care about or higher, then you can, there's ways you can recalibrate it and make it work. You may find somebody is selling a directional coupler that's rated for 500 to 1,000 megacycles. And you would say, well, I could squeeze in 432, but I'd worry about 144 megahertz. It'll work like a charm at 144 megs. And there's an article in the Mike and Mike website. Mike number two website is landmarktechnet.com. And there's an article there by K2RIW about using directional couplers for power measurement and VisWell measurement, and how to recalibrate them even though they're not on the right frequency region. And so that's a very inexpensive approach, which once you know what you're doing, is a very sophisticated approach, Ray.
Quick comment, Dick?
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Also, you have to remember, most of the hams are thinking true line watt meters, where you really don't need that if you use a directional coupler. That'll handle anything up to 500 watts with no problem. So you're only tapping off a very small amount of signal. You don't have to worry about the power handling of the meter. It'll handle whatever comes out of that rectifier. So that is an excellent system. I've used it many times. So you don't have to always worry about through line and worrying about how much wattage you're going to be handling. It'll cover the spectrum.
Yeah, that's another very good point, John. Thank you. And so that directional coupler we're describing really is a through-line watt meter. The theory of operation of a Bird Model 43 and the theory of operation of a directional coupler that you can buy in a flea market, they work by the exact same process, Ray. KC2MMY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, let me just clarify. I want to know what I can do with my 25-watt input HP digital power meter. What can I do with that? What's the typical application? What do they use it for? And then maybe we can use it for ham radio. I guess I could use it for HTs if I wanted to be direct, put a direct 5-watt input into them. That's one question. The other question is the directional coupler. I'm not sure what that does. Is that, if you put that on a line, does it give you power to your meter in only one direction and then not let it flow in the other direction, kind of like a diode? What's a directional coupler exactly? So those two questions there. Okay, H2MM1.
You said you've already got a 25-watt power meter. And I think you said it's Hewlett Packard. What model number is that, Ray? Go ahead.
I don't know, Dick. I didn't buy it yet. It's on eBay, and I want to buy it. But it's like a 646 or something like that. It's I don't remember. I can't look right now.
Okay, so there's a meter on eBay that you want to buy that measures up to 25 watts. And by there's at least two or three different techniques you can use to measure higher than 25 watts. One is to put an attenuator in front of it. Another is to put the directional coupler, not exactly in front of it, on one side. Directional coupler. Definition, it has a straight through line where 99% of the power flows through the straight through line, from the input connector right straight to the output connector. What a directional coupler does is it's got a second line inside that's close to the main line, and it samples from the power. As that power flows down the main line, a little bit of it, maybe a couple of percent, depending on what directional coupler, is it a 6 dB, 10 dB, or 20 dB directional coupler, that tells you what percentage of the power flowing straight through the directional coupler does it sample. And that power that it samples, it supplies it to the third port. It's called directional coupler depending on whether you use, let's assume now the input connector, I'm going to call it J1, and the output connector J2, and the sampling port J3. You put your power into J1, take it out of J2, it's now measuring forward power. Reverse J1 and J2, put your transmitter on J2, and you load on J1 instead, and now you're measuring the reverse power. You're measuring the reflection from your antenna, if you know what I mean. And the ratio between the two is called standing wave ratio with a little bit of mathematics. But that third port, the J3 port, is the sampling port. Let me drop. You can put your power meter on the sampling port, or you can put a crystal diode detector on the sampling port. Let's assume now that the particular directional coupler you get is a 10 decibel directional coupler. That means whatever power is flowing down the straight through line in the desired direction, 10% of it, 10 dB down, it's a 10 dB directional coupler, 10% of it appears on the third port, J3. If you've got a 10 dB directional coupler and you put your 25 watt power meter on J3, it'll read full scale when 250 watts is flowing through the straight through line, J1 to J2, if you know what I mean. So it samples a small amount of the power in the correct direction. And that sample power, you can put it directly into a diode rectifier or into a power meter. The choice is yours. KC2MMY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, run a check, TechNet's perfect. I have to find one of those. That'd be really cool. And I was looking up some circuits on the internet, and I believe you can build some sampling devices with a Pi type. We could go either resistive, I think two resistors and one down the middle. That would be the T. It's also a Pi one. Which you can build with resistors. Only three. The resistors is all you need, or capacitors to do the sampling. But it would be nice to find it, something already built like that. And yeah, I can imagine why. They're probably very high quality, cost a lot of money. I've never run into one. I don't think I've ever even seen an attenuator on a table yet. But, you know, when you're not looking for it, you don't see it. So well, next time I go to a ham fest, I'll see if I can pick one of those up. And thanks for the info all on the power meters. I think I'm going to get that HP power meter because I think I could use it for a few things. Over.
Yeah, almost everything HP made is rather high in quality. And therefore, usually can't go wrong.
Dick?
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
HP power meters tend to be a power head, which, you know, the maximum you're going to stick in it is maybe 0 dBm if you're lucky. You know, if you're going to use an HP power meter with a thermocouple head, you need some form of attenuator or directional coupler to hook it to.
What you're saying, Eric, is true 95% of the time. Hewlett-Packard did make a version of their power meter that has a great big finned attenuator in front of it, and it really is rated for 25 watts input to the power head. Hewlett-Packard does have a model like that, and it sounds like, from what Ray has told us, that's the one he's looking at on eBay. It really is rated for 25 watts input. So it's a rare item, but Hewlett-Packard does have one with that built-in attenuator on the front end. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
All right, is this a digital power meter that reads to thousandths of a watt?
The version that I saw was an analog meter. In other words, it had an analog detecting circuit, display circuit. I thought I had one sitting on the bench here at one time. If I did, I could read the model number to you. But the power head was an analog power head, Eric. Go ahead.
All right, so it's 100 years old. Okay, I'll give you that. But the line of fire for the last 20 years is just, you know, it's a thermocouple. Maybe the through line stuff a bit.
Dick, if it's a 432, it needs a thermistor head.
He thought it was a 600 number, HP 6 something or other. That sounds right. The one that I've got, which I thought I had it sitting on the bench here with me, but apparently I don't, has an attenuator in the front end on the actual power head itself. I think the power head is a 1 watt full scale, and it's got something like a 10 dB high power attenuator in the front end of it. So assuming now that the guy selling this Hewlett-Packard meter is telling the truth and it's rated for 25 watts full scale, that could be a very handy device. So good luck with that one, Ray. KC2MMY for any final comments. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, yeah, it has a big fat end connector on it, so it definitely may take some power. And it is 25 watt input. I double checked it. I got the PDF and everything on a different site, so it definitely will take 25 watts to make that. In fact, they're selling a few of them, you know. So I don't think I can go wrong. Thank you for the information. That was educational. And let you go on to the next person. Thank you. Thanks, John, too.
Yeah, good luck with that project, and hope you can tell us later on the actual model number so I can look it up and confirm it's the one that I'm familiar with. And as I said, almost all the stuff HP made is pretty darn good. Of all the things they've made over all the years, the only thing that I ever known that company made that was a dud was the Hewlett-Packard Model 150 oscilloscope, built way back in the early 70s. And it was a loser because the high voltage power supply kept failing. And they wanted that thing to die so bad that they gave them such a black eye that they wouldn't even supply spare parts for it. They just wanted that thing to be thrown into the garbage. So they did have one bad item in all of their years, but they've made hundreds and hundreds of other things that people think are pretty good gold. Mr. Hewlett, Mr. Packard, the particular garage in, let me think now, I can't think of the name of the town in California right now.
Palo Alto?
Palo Alto is the place. Their little garage in Palo Alto, California, where they first came up with their Wienbridge resistor capacitor type oscillator, Model 200. A 200 oscillator put them on the map. An extremely intelligent design. This is an audio oscillator that went from 20 hertz. I think the first version went up from 20 hertz to at least 200 kilohertz, if not to 2 megacycles. Really, really nice design. Okay. See if we have anyone else that wants to check in with a question or a comment for the TechNet. Give me your call letters and your name right now. K2RIW listening.
Hey, Jerry Jack.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I want you to tone to that frequency and use it, and I want to make sure it sounds okay.
I gave two tests, and I went to the frequency I used to use, and the last number used to be 0.1, and I went to 0.125 instead, with the same PO I used to use, and I got no response.
0.125.
Yes, I know. 0.1 is the frequency I used to use. I made 0.125 with the same PO as I used to use. I got no response.
0.1125. 4 digits after the decimal point.
Roger, Dodger, stand by.
John, that's a 436A model while he's waiting there.
A 436. Okay, that one I'm not familiar with. Dick may be right. That may have a 25-watt input connector. But all the 430s, 432s, and 434 I know took a thermistor probe in the front end that you had to have on the cable, just like Eric said. But, okay, very good. And I will research that also. But, you know, if it's reasonably priced, buy it because the thermistors are not that expensive anyway.
K2RIW testing. How about that? It's working. Boy,
Hey, Eric, I got another frequency. Good thing that you corrected me. K2EJ for any of the comments. K2RIW.
K2RIW,
K2EJ.
Keep it to yourself, tell no one. And enjoy it for the moment. It'll stay like that for a while. When I was making my own inline, that's what all that noise was about.
I understand. So you're saying all that noise was your own interbot. That's what you're saying, Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, I calculated the frequency of the, actually it's not a DMI machine, it's an NXI machine. It's actually one of those things that the police department uses to talk to their laptops in the car with. But it was occurring in actually a preamp that I use as a preamp and disc amplifier because it's got 8 outputs. So it didn't like seeing that much signal in the input.
Message for Eric. I'm very glad though that this receiver that's hearing me on that frequency is wide enough because my particular transmitter only moves in 5 kilohertz steps. So I'm using 110, 115. Yeah, 110 works. I can't get to 1125. I don't have 2.5 KC of offset. I've only got 5 KC steps in my particular transmitter, Eric, but it's working. Thank goodness it's got some bandwidth to it. Over to you, Eric, and I think John wants to say something to you. Good audio on this thing, by the way.
Well, if you go to the settings of that particular radio, if you set it for 12.5 kilohertz steps, it'll come up in the right place. You probably just purely out of habit, and as opposed to the UHF band plan, you go by 5 kilohertz, but whatever.
It's got nice sounding audio, by the way. Well done. KC2WGB, K2IW, go ahead, John.
Yes, Dick, the audio is fine. Yeah, it sounds real good. Eric, by the way, I don't know if you were informed, but I told K2KNB that exact sound that we had here, I heard on 125, also the UHF frequency, earlier in the week. It was going on for 2 days. I don't know if you did anything about that one.
Okay, that one is a jammer, and that is the MR, and I've been able to read it.
Okay, very good.
Okay, back to normal operation. One last call. There's a little bit of a piece of information I'm going to give you guys if there isn't somebody with another question. So do we have any other person standing by now that all the bad noise is going away that wants to give us a question or a comment in the general ham radio section of the internet, of the tech net? K2RIW listening. Anybody out there got a further question or comment?
Hey, just a comment, K2MMY, it was a 436A, just so you know, I looked it up, thanks. K2MMY.
Yeah, I think the 436A is the digital version, and that's the actual meter itself. The power head you add to it, Hewlett-Packard has got a zillion power heads, and maybe this particular machine you're about to buy has the power head that's rated for 25 watts input. I own one of those. I just can't find it right now. And if I could find it on thing, I'd be able to read the model number of the power head. When you saw a picture of it, did the power head not only have a great big type-N connector on it, but was there a black square item behind that type-N connector with some fins on it, air fins? Did you see those fins on that power sensing head that's on that power meter? Over to you, Ray, K2RIW.
No, I didn't notice any fins. I just noticed that big fat end connector, because, you know, when it said 25 watts, I questioned myself. And I looked up the unit in the manual for that particular model, and it says it's native input power is 25 watts. It doesn't have any extra heads or extra fins or pieces that you put on there, unless there's something I don't know about and there's an extra piece that, you know, you put on the cable that they're not telling me. But the big fat end connector, you know, it says, you know, the nominal input's 25 watts.
That sounds awful good. That could be an awful nice meter to own if it's what I think it is. Good luck with that project, Ray. I'll try looking that up a little bit later. Okay, last week we had a NMO connector. Joe, W-H-R-Y-Y, brought to our attention that he was doing an exact study of the WIP antenna he was using on either 2 meters or 450. I'm not sure which. I think it was 2 meters. His particular 2-meter WIP antenna with an NMO connector made by Motorola. He carefully measured the length. He measured the way the thing behaved at its operating frequency, and the mathematics didn't come out right. In other words, it behaved beautifully, had a nice low standing wave ratio, but the length was too short. And he was asking me the question, how in the world did they make the antenna properly resonate with that short a length? That was the nature of his question. And by way of Professor Mike, who came along, WY2U, he brought to our attention the fact that there's extra length of the cable inside of the base of the NMO connector, the actual assembly itself. It's got some extra length, and that's where the missing length was, both by its velocity factor and its real physical length. But let me show you what I think was really going on here. There's an interesting story here. Let me drop it. If I was doing a quick and dirty job of building myself a 2-meter ground plane antenna, I might very well start off with a SO239 chassis mount UHF connector, and from the four holes I would attach four pieces of wire acting as the four ground plane radials, and from the center conductor I would hang a WIP approximately 19 inches long if I was doing it at 2 meters. And as a quick and dirty way of building a 2-meter ground plane antenna, that's pretty nice. It would do the job, but it wouldn't be able to survive being mounted on the top of an automobile and survive the wind loading of a 60-mile-an-hour car and hitting branches of trees and whatever. By the same token, if Motorola made their 2-meter NMO-mounted antenna, and if it had the world's most perfect impedance match, it has a 1.03 standing wave ratio at its rated frequency, and you're using it, and you'd fall in love with it. But if it fell apart, boy, you would say terrible things about Motorola. Conversely, if it was built in a way that was very rugged, and it didn't have an absolute perfect standing wave ratio, 1.03, had a standing wave ratio of 1.4, you'd be pretty happy with that. So for the thing to hang together mechanically and give you reliable service for the next 5 years, that's the main thing you care about, whether you know it or not. And its actual electrical performance, to a small degree, is secondary. By the way that they made that thing, the physical arrangement of that little 270-degree rotated little curlicue on the bottom of the actual stainless steel whip itself so that it can't pull through the rubber of the connector and the rest of the mechanism, it's a very sturdy mechanical structure at the base. It happens to simultaneously have very good electrical performance and standing wave ratio and power handling. Let me drop the... So, mechanical survivability is really the highest reliability, is the highest priority you've got when you're building a mechanical structure like that when you're going to sell zillions of them. And then the electrical performance is somewhat secondary. Once we... I've got an intermittent connection. My power connector has all of a sudden... Stand by a minute. My power connector has become intermittent as I wriggled it by mistake. So mechanical survivability is their highest priority, and that's the way they built it. And we sort of figured out how they did it and why it's so rugged. And now, because they got just the right length, just the right amount of stray capacitance in the base, by way of those Brown and Woodward curves and that article you can read about getting perfect impedance match to a dipole, which really is the exact same philosophy as getting perfect impedance match to a monopole. You read that article in Mike Number Two's website, limarktechnet.com, by KQRIW, you'll find out that by nothing but